there's a lot that goes on in same-sex relationships that tends to be, isn't always, but tends to be more egalitarian, because a same-sex relationship is a negotiation, and there isn't a script that gets written for us, so we get to write our own scripts.
That's the brilliant and fantastic Dan Savage.
He tells us what straight couples can learn from same-sex couples on this episode of The Gender Knot, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. We're your hosts. I'm Nasrin Tavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman. Dan Savage gives us tips on better relationships and what same-sex couples can teach us all.
Gay people are better at sex, know more about sex, and have more sex than straight people do. And it's not because we're magic, although we are, but it's not related. The reason we're better at sex is that we are forced to communicate in a way that we can't avoid.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Gender Knot, the podcast where we try to figure out new gender roles for the modern era. We're on hiatus. We're going to be back in mid-October, but we thought we'd give you a bit of a treat with Dan Savage this week.
In case you don't know, Dan Savage is an author, a journalist, an LGBT activist. He's the host of a fantastic podcast called The Savage Lovecast, which Naz is a big, huge fan of, and I catch an episode every once in a while. And people call in with relationship dilemmas, and he's had a column for years called Savage Love. I mean, I remember reading it in the Village Voice when, sadly, there was actually a Village Voice.
Yeah,
that's a bummer.
Yeah, but the Lovecast is wicked. Like, his advice is just so no nonsense. That is fantastic.
Absolutely, and he puts things, and he does on this interview as well, in such a great, really succinct, simple for everyone to understand, yet also difficult to follow.
Gets to the point, man.
Absolutely.
Straight to the point. So we're going to hear from him in a minute. Just a little bit of news. So Freeman, you're going to be leaving us.
I am.
Yeah.
And I am.
It's been wicked doing this.
All good things come to an end, or at least, you know, a pregnant pause.
It's been wicked having our back and forth. So I hope you'll be back for more, hopefully, arguments.
I don't necessarily think it's necessary for us to argue, but I guess we could end this on an argument about arguing, which would be sort of a meta thing. But yeah, no, it's been great, and I look forward to helping to contribute to the empire that is the Gender Knot, and is continuing onward.
And so last season we were looking at women and work, men and relationships, because I'm building an empire and you're looking for a wife.
Well, I don't know if we've been successful at either thing, considering that, I mean, I don't know how your empire building's going, but my wife effort, I mean, I think finally a friend of mine said, have you actually been on any dates? And I said, you know, I've been on two, I think, in the last year. So that's not really very successful.
Yeah, but I feel like,
and in fairness, one of those dates was sort of on accident.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like you've told me that you often don't know if you're on a date. That was the accidental date.
But no, I mean, like, really, it's been all dissertation all the time, which hopefully is going to be finishing soon. And, you know, thank God.
And you'll be Dr. Freeman. So Jonathan, hopefully we're going to have you back sometime in the future. We're going to be back with the next season of The Gender Knot in mid-October. So do subscribe and look out for us then.
Absolutely. And so let's get back to our fun and fantastic guests. Naz, Sam, and Johnny had a fantastic conversation with him a couple weeks ago and, you know, really talked about a lot of different points. The most important and neat thing was what people can learn through communication from same-sex couples and whatnot. But what's really important for all of our friends and Gender Knot family is that this is definitely not safe for work.
Yeah.
So for all of you blaring this in the middle of your workday,
or in the car with the kids.
Or in the car with the kids.
Save this one for later.
Save this one for, you know, adult time.
Yeah, but great wisdom, but yeah, just not
absolutely
not safe for work wisdom.
That's your warning.
What can mixed sex couples learn from same sex couples?
So much. The easy jokey answers are brunch and sit ups, but there's a lot that goes on in same sex relationships that tends to be, isn't always, but tends to be more egalitarian, because a same sex relationship is a negotiation. And there isn't a script that gets written for us. So we get to write our own scripts. The example I always point to is monogamy. In same-sex relationships, monogamy is opt-in. It's a conversation that you have. It's a choice that you make as a couple. It's not a default setting that you just kind of back into. And there isn't an assumption around monogamy. Also, when it comes to sex, you know, gay people are better at sex, know more about sex, and have more sex than straight people do. And it's not because we're magic, although we are, but it's not related. The reason we're better at sex is that we are forced to communicate in a way that we can't avoid. And there are straight people out there who are good communicators, who talk with their partners about sex and make active, informed choices, can, you know, express what they want and solicit from their partner what their desires might be. But a lot of straight people, and I think the majority, avoid that conversation. And a same-sex couple can't avoid that conversation. Because when two men crawl into bed together, what happens next can't be assumed. You know, straight people, they get to yes, they get to consent to sex, and they stop talking because sex is vaginal intercourse. And so there's nothing further, nothing more to discuss, really. Nothing you're forced to discuss. You know, two guys get into bed with both their dicks and both their buttholes, if they are cisgendered guys. And what happens next is a conversation. That's the beginning of the conversation. After the yes, you know, they begin to talk about what are you into, what are you not into. And I'm always saying, when I speak to, you know, predominantly straight audiences, if there's anything that straight people could steal from gay culture that would improve straight relationships, it is what I call the four magic words. What are you into? And that is the question that, you know, whenever two men go to bed together, one or the other or both ask that question, what are you into? And at that moment, both are empowered to rule anything in and anything out. It is why gay people are better at sex, not because we're magic, but because we have to have this conversation that so many straight people avoid. And it often blows the minds of straight people when they hear that, you know, two men go to bed, somebody says, what are you into? And one of them will say, I'm not into anal. And that blows a lot of straight people's minds, because the equivalent in straight line would be, I'm not into vaginal. And for straight people, that is sex. And so saying, I want to have sex with you, but then I don't want to have sex, is how a lot of straight people would read that. What's actually going on is the gay person is saying, I'm into mutual masturbation. I'm into oral sex. There's sort of fantasy play that I'm into. I'm into frottage. I'm into rolling around. But right now, not tonight, am I up for penetration or anal penetration in either direction. So let's do all these other really fun, amazing things. That's why gay people get to have more sex than straight people do, because we define sex more broadly. And that makes our sex lives immeasurably better.
I'm thinking of times on your show when often women have called in, and, you know, something that isn't, I mean, it's not a strange thing, is like if a woman's just given birth or had some sort of medical condition or something, sex becomes a tricky subject for straight couples. So it's kind of interesting you saying that, because it seems to be like, are straight people just really limited and kind of just how they incorporate sex into their lives?
Yes, they are. And the problem often, you know, post-childbirth or some medical condition is, you know, the options that are available have been treated, you know, for the couple all their life or all his life. You know, the options that might be fun and pleasurable for both are a tragic consolation prize and not sex. You know, we can't have sex. I guess I'll have a hand job instead. And how sad is that? Or we're just going to have oral sex, or we're going to do mutual masturbation. And how tragic is that? That's not sex. We're not having sex. We're doing these, you know, third place trophies instead, or getting these consolation prizes instead of sex. And in gay land, that's sex too. And it's good sex. It doesn't always have to be somebody gets fucked. And I'm always telling straight, like, can I say fuck on your podcast?
Yeah, you can say whatever you like.
You know, I get, you know, if you're a out gay guy like me, I talk to a lot of straight guys because of the column and the podcast. I also have a lot of straight male friends, and they're often jealous. Straight guys will confide in their gay male friends about how easy it is for us to get laid, for gay men to get laid. And the first thing I tell them is, do something about sexual violence. And that'll solve a large part of that problem. Like, a woman is always having to weigh, particularly with a new partner, fear of sexual violence against wanting to act on her desire, maybe to be with this guy. And so solve that, fight rape culture, and you'll solve that. But also, you know, if every time you said yes to sex, straight guy, your ass got fucked, you wouldn't say yes to sex as often as you might. And so to be the penetrated one always during sex, you know, there's times you just don't want a dick stuck in you. And you might want to have sex. You might want to have an orgasm. You might want to have that kind of intimacy and connection. But you just don't feel like getting fucked. And if you say that to straight guys, every time you said yes to sex, I bet you got bent over and your ass got reamed. Would you say yes every time? No. Sometimes you just wouldn't be feeling it. Sometimes you wouldn't want someone inside your body. You might want someone on your body, next to your body, touching your body. But there are just times when you're not, you know, mentally in the place where you're, where penetration is what you need or feel that you want or feel ready for. And sometimes you, you know, as I say, this is someone who sometimes gets penetrated. Sometimes you're like, you know what, let's mess around. Let's do this. Let's do that. These are great things. I don't feel like getting fucked. And then you start messing around and you suddenly feel like getting fucked and you upgrade. But you do that in this, you know, in Gayland, in this posture where if there is no upgrade to, you know, full sex, to penetrative sex, and I hate that kind of hierarchical language around penetrative sex because I don't think it's at the pinnacle. I don't think it's the top. But if, you know, you can have sex and whatever else you're doing besides penetration is sex and is just as good and just as much fun, in the moment you might then feel like you want to upgrade. But if you go into it always feeling like you're going to be under pressure to eventually agree to penetrative sex, you know, if you're with somebody, and I hear this from a lot of women, you know, he says, okay, let's just do oral, let's just do mutual masturbation. And then invariably, partway through, they try to initiate penetrative sex because that's what they really wanted. And they weren't satisfied with the consolation prizes on offer. And so straight people, if you want to have a better sex life, jack off together more, roll around together more, stop treating these other things like, you know, lovely parting gifts for the contestant on the game show who lost.
What happens when you suggest this to straight guys?
Well, their heads explode because they think all gay sex is anal sex, just like all straight sex is vaginal intercourse. And so for them to find out that that's not always the case, in fact, 25% of gay men, roughly, according to a couple of surveys, never have anal sex. They're not virgins. They're not celibates. They're doing all this other stuff that is just as satisfying and just as much fun. So, you know, when I think about what straight people can learn from gay people, besides that our relationships tend to be more egalitarian, we do sex better because we communicate and because we have a broader repertoire of acts we enjoy, of things we engage in, and it doesn't always have to be somebody's getting fucked.
Part of this season, we're looking at men and relationships. When it comes to straight men and their relationships, what do you think gets in the way of them having better relationships with women?
The way masculinity is performed is a huge problem because masculinity isn't a positive thing. It's a two pairs of negatives. It's a pair of negatives. It's, you know, to be a straight guy is not to be a faggot, not to be a woman. And so anything that's vaguely faggy and anything that's feminine is not allowed. And it's not just straight guys who do this to themselves and each other. Gay men do this to straight men, and straight women do this to straight men, where we police them for evidence that their straightness is not real. I don't get letters ever from guys wondering if their boyfriends are really straight. I get letters every day from girls wondering if their boyfriends are really gay. And I'll sometimes have email exchanges with these women and find out that their boyfriends love to have sex, initiate it all the time, eat their pussies, but their boyfriend likes to have a finger in the butt during oral intercourse. Their boyfriend likes to have the nipples played with. Their boyfriend has feelings. And all of these things are evidence that they're not truly masculine, not 100% straight. So straight guys, of course, police each other constantly for evidence that, you know, and bust each other and then have to perform this kind of hyper-masculinity to maintain their straight guy bona fides. But it's not just straight guys doing that to each other. And, you know, the example I always use is a woman can say that she, you know, even went down on another woman, had sex with a woman in the context of a three-way, even had a relationship with a woman for a while, the college cliche, right? And she identifies as straight, and nobody goes, you're not really straight. You couldn't have done that if you were straight. But a guy, a straight guy, who says that he once, like, got off with a guy, made out with a guy, sucked a dick, who says he's straight, no one's ever going to believe him.
What you're pointing to is how women sort of constrain men and their sexualities or their performance of masculinity.
Absolutely. I think men are the chief culprits here, you know, in how they define and perform masculinity and police each other. Most of the, you know, bullying or hazing that men get for being less than manly comes at the hands of other men. That said, there is a lot of sort of casting of doubt and suspicion that straight guys are subjected to by their sex partners. which then reinforces this dynamic around having to perform this kind of hypermasculinity and never let their guard down. There was a study, and I don't have it handy, so I can't give you the name of it, but it shouldn't be too hard to look up. They wanted to look at stress among gay men and straight men. So they were measuring cortisone, the stress hormone in their bodies. And the assumption going in was that gay men would have much higher levels of cortisone, the stress hormone, because of homophobia, because of violence, because of most religious traditions that are really homophobic. And they found the opposite, that straight guys had higher levels of cortisone in their bodies, higher levels of stress. And I think that's because once you tell people you're gay, once you're out and getting comfortable with yourself, you can relax. A straight guy can never relax. There are ways in which I'm pretty feminine. There's ways in which I'm pretty masculine. And my husband doesn't freak the fuck out that the ways in which I'm pretty traditionally masculine mean I must be straight.
We're in this era of redefining masculinity. So there's so much talk about this, especially over the past few years. I'm wondering, are the nature of questions you're getting from straight couples different? And especially from women, given what you've said about the ways in which there's a lot of pressure on straight men to sort of perform this masculinity all the time in front of their partners.
The questions I'm getting have shifted over the years, have changed. You know, I say I get this question constantly from women worried that their boyfriends or husbands are really gay. And I do get it constantly, but not at the rate I got it 25 years ago when I first started writing the column. There is, I think, because of the movement around, you know, trans rights and trans identity and a more nuanced and complicated understanding of gender, I think there are fewer people who are freaking out about this. And of course, my readership tends to be a little bit more up on these issues and less hyper about these things. But still, I get that question every day. Is my boyfriend gay? And the evidence they cite isn't I caught him in bed with a man, not the browser history is all gay, man on man porn, not all the lights have to be off and he only wants to do anal. The evidence is he has feelings. He likes Broadway show tunes. He likes to have his nipples played with while he's eating my pussy. Like questions like that, which just blow my mind.
Are you still getting those kinds of questions, or are these questions from like a decade ago?
No, I get those questions daily, but I used to get 30 a day, and now I get a dozen, 10, but still enough to point to a problem. And when you consider that my audience is a self-selected group of people who are, I hope, particularly after reading or listening for a while, a little bit more educated about these issues than the average person might be, is remarkable that I still get that question so often.
How are the nature of questions changing in general? Because not only do we have all this stuff about redefining masculinity, we also have like women and their role in society changing and them becoming a lot more empowered and maybe taking on more masculine roles at work, even in relationships. Yeah, just wondering how the questions are changing.
We're going to have to redefine what it means to be male and female to take the power politics out of it. And maleness, masculinity for so long has been linked to dominance and control and mastery. We have to embrace different definitions of masculinity, not just men, but also women. You know, I get questions frequently from women who view their male partners as less than masculine and therefore less arousing because their partners make less money than they do, have a less high-powered career or job than they do. And, you know, my husband is a stay-at-home dad, and, you know, I am still the sole breadwinner. And I never thought, oh, that means he's not a man. But I get that question from women. And, you know, with that kind of empowerment comes really a responsibility, as Laura Kipnis said in an essay in the New York Review of Books, but on a different subject, but still I want to cite it. You know, she said in the Me Too movement and at this time, we're asking men to unlearn the toxic ways in which they've been socialized. We need to ask women to unlearn the ways in which they've been socialized as well.
It's interesting you point to this because I think still a lot of women feel that they can't outperform their partners when it comes to work, for example.
There are men absolutely who are threatened by being with a woman who outperforms them professionally and at work. There's going to be more and more of that. You know, more and more women are going to college. In the United States, there are many, many more women, much higher percentage of women in college than men in college. So the future is a greater percentage of the population consisting of high-performing women who are out-earning the men in their lives. Not just men who have to embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was trying to say earlier. It's also women have to embrace that. It's not just men who feel threatened when their female partners out-earn them. Often it's women who view their male partners as less than masculine if they, the women in the relationship, out-earn the men.
You talked about your husband being a stay-at-home dad. What about women whose husbands are stay-at-home dads? Do you get many questions from them? Because I'm wondering, do they feel like their femininity is threatened or their role as a mother or anything like that?
I don't get many questions from women in that situation with stay-at-home dads. I know personally families with stay-at-home dads where the woman is the sole breadwinner, and it doesn't seem to play out. I don't see women, the women I know personally, are freaking out about that. But it does seem to be an issue for some, but not for people who are contacting me.
So, Dan, a moment ago you mentioned the Me Too movement. Something else we wanted to ask you about is how have the nature of questions from straight men changed in this post-Me Too era? And especially because we're constantly reading about men saying things like, they don't know how to approach women, they don't know what's acceptable anymore, are they allowed to do this or that? Like, there seems to be a real fear amongst a lot of straight men. So I'm wondering what they're asking you.
They're asking me to give them instructions. They're asking for a guidebook. You know, Caitlin Moran wrote this terrific essay, I think, in The Spectator about encountering shitty men and there not being a guidebook for women that can unpack how to navigate sex and relationships. And I thought it was a beautiful essay, in part because she kind of unexpectedly took this turn toward the end where she began to talk about how there isn't a guidebook for men either on how to behave or what's expected of them. And how to navigate these things, that everybody's out there supposedly, you know, everyone's pushed out into the sexual marketplace, to use a terrible term, and expected to learn by trial and error. And what we know is that there are people out there who are malicious, monsters, but there are also people out there who are just screwing up. But the screwing up in that area can traumatize someone, but there is no guidebook. So a lot of the questions I get are, how do I do this? How do I flirt with somebody? How do I approach somebody? And the advice, it's actually pretty simple when you think about it. You know, if you want to kiss somebody, ask them. And people are like, but that's not how it looks in the movies. It's supposed to be natural. You're supposed to be overwhelmed by desire and lean in for that kiss. And the problem with that is dickful thinking. Like, you may think that she wants you to kiss her, but that's just dick wishing on a star. It's not what she wants. And you can't read her mind. And so you might want to, and people think, oh, but if I ask, that's not sexy. Then it's absolutely sexy to say to somebody, can I kiss you? And get a yes, right? The trick for men, and I'm constantly unpacking this with guys on my podcast, is that women are socialized to defer to men and women are afraid of men because men are violent, testosterone, so dick monsters. And so a woman might give you a yes that is given under duress that you did not intend to cause. That's just her being afraid in that moment. And so guys have to learn to really err on the side of inviting rejection, of asking for the no, not asking for the yes. You know, you say to somebody that you want to hit on, that you want to, you know, ask out, before you get to the ask, you invite the no. You say, look, I'm going to ask you something. If the answer is no, please tell me no. I promise I'm not going to, like, freak out. I'm a grown up. I can take rejection. I would like to ask you out on a date. And then see what they say. And if they need to, if you've empowered them to say no, then you're not going to waste your time on a date with someone who doesn't want to be there. And you might get a yes that you wouldn't have gotten if you hadn't taken an approach that made a woman feel like she could go out on a date with you if she was feeling ambivalent. Like, I might be into him, I might not be into him. Asking for that no made her feel like, you know what, if I go on a date with him and then it's no, he's not going to have a meltdown.
This is sort of basic communication, right? So I'm wondering again, why is there a lack of this? You know, why do you think... Why do you think we struggle with these basic questions? And often people will ask you questions where on your show, well, you'll respond with just talk to her or just be straight with him about what you want.
Use your words. I'm constantly telling people, use your words, because people get terrible sex education. You know, sex ed is reproductive biology, not how you talk someone into fucking you. That's where sex gets complicated. That's where sex gets difficult. And people's insecurities come into play and people get, you know, are traumatized by an experience or traumatized by having traumatized someone without any intent to harm them because there was no explicit, no ability to have an open, honest conversation where somebody could put their no on the table and leave. And we don't teach people how to talk about sex because we don't, you know, in a sex negative culture, we don't really think people should be having sex. So we want to send people out there in the world ill-prepared around how to negotiate about sex, because wouldn't it be better if nobody did that thing? But, you know, circling back to the beginning of our conversation, it's one of the advantages gay people have. Before you could be a gay person, you had to open your mouth and say something that risked rejection, inviting the rejection of your parents and your siblings and your friends and your church. And that puts you in a position where telling your truth, asking for what you want, saying what you are and who you are, isn't as scary.
Is this fear of rejection generational as well?
No, I think it's a constant. everyone fears rejection. We just have to turn it on its head. Rejection is a kind of freedom. Like if somebody rejects you, you're free to go find somebody who wants you. The longer someone takes to get to rejecting you, if they don't want to be with you, the more of your time they're wasting, the more of your time they're wasting. So I'm always encouraging people to embrace and rush toward rejection, not be such an asshole that they reject you because you're a jerk, but invite it. And when it comes, regard it as freedom, not as negation.
I think for women, this is a big fear of ours that, you know, if you reject a guy, there will be consequences. I don't just mean physical, but like, you know, it's kind of, I think there's a lot of navigating men's sensitivity to rejection.
Right. And then men complain about being strung along or being lied to.
Right.
Often it's women who are afraid of just putting the no on the table because they don't want to be called a bitch, or they don't want the guy to freak out and get angry. Then men are partly then the author of their own misery. Why didn't she just tell me no? Well, did you give her permission to tell you no? Knowing that women are socialized to defer to men, knowing that women are socialized never really to say, to give a direct no answer to men, lest they seem too emasculating or powerful, lest they risk violence. You have to invite it. You have to, a guy has to control for that in a sensitive way. And you know, if you don't want women stringing along or wasting your time, and you know, because I'm telling you with my listeners on my podcast, and you know that women are less likely to give you a direct answer, you need to ask for that direct answer.
Dan, if you had to give a big tip to men and to women in today's post-Me Too era, what would it be in terms of how to like navigate these waters?
Use your words.
Okay.
Talk it out. No sudden moves. Don't initiate physically, initiate verbally, recognizing, of course, that sexual harassment can be verbal. You know, just using your words doesn't protect you or protect others. Use your words wisely and judiciously and be solicitous. Don't try to be seductive. You know, I always go back to that can I kiss you thing. The first time a guy kissed me, you know, I was hanging out at his apartment. I was 16 years old. I didn't know what was going on or how to initiate. And he looked at me, I was laying my head in his lap, and he looked at me and said, "What would you do if I kissed you?" That was the sexiest fucking thing anyone had ever said to me when I was 16 years old. I almost came in my pants then, right? And all I said back, I said, "I would kiss you back." And it was super fucking hot. I don't remember the kiss. I don't remember what it felt like when our lips came together. I don't remember, you know, what his spit tasted like. I remember what he said. And what he said was fucking hot. And I wish you saw more of that in film and television, because we have such lousy sex ed. And I think the UK has pretty lousy sex ed too. You learn about sex from porn, and we learn about sex from television, and we learn about sex from movies. And what is shown there is not people using their words, is not people asking questions, even in a sexy way. What is shown there is people lunging at each other, and men lunging at women primarily. And this is held up as how it's done when it's good and normal and natural, and you shouldn't have to talk about it. It should just happen spontaneously. And, you know, Harvey Weinstein happened to a lot of women spontaneously, as did Louis C.K. And it's not sexy, and it's not cool. And as I hope more and more men now realize, it's potentially, you know, professional and social death.
I mean, I will say one thing. As a woman, hearing a lot of the concerns guys have at the moment, and I know this sounds unfair, but it sometimes does sound a bit manipulative. You know, you have all these questions from guys being like, "Oh, am I allowed to like wave to my coworker anymore? Am I allowed to like flirt with anyone?" I mean, the female perspective, I think, is kind of like, if you need to ask that, then you have way bigger things to be sorting out. I don't know. Is that unfair? Because I think a lot of us women are kind of annoyed at some of the questions straight men are asking at the moment?
If we were in the same room during this interview, you might reach across the table and slap me because I'm about to not all men you. Hashtag not all men. Like, I see that too out there in the world, that there are guys who are saying that. Like, well, it's not all guys are saying that. And so the guys who are saying that are definitely part of the problem. And they're the ones actually that you don't want waving at you. They're the ones that you do want to be self-conscious about every move they make. Any guy who would say that should be feeling under the microscope. And the guys who aren't saying that, I think we should pay a little bit of attention to them too, because they're probably not the guys with the problem and probably not the guys who are causing the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think the worry a lot of women have is that, again, it goes back to the sort of navigating men's rejection is like, if you say anything, then, you know, you have to deal with a barrage of these kinds of questions or get told that you're shaming men or you're silencing men. And so, I don't know, it's kind of like everyone sort of not wanting to listen to the other party or silencing each other.
Yeah, unfortunately, but you know, on the upside, there are some guys out there who need to shut the fuck up. So there's some silencing that's going on that's going to be beneficial.
So Dan, I'm going to see if Sam and Johnny have any questions. Is there anything?
Hi, Dan. At the beginning, we asked about what straight couples can learn from gay couples, and you mentioned just being more egalitarian. And I'm wondering, especially, I mean, inside the bedroom, but also outside the bedroom, kind of if there's any specific lessons that you think can be learned in that egalitarian sense.
There are lots of studies that show that the egalitarianism in same-sex relationship isn't just about sex. The division of household labor doesn't default to gendered expectations around who's going to do what. And to be the man, you know, male same-sex couple, somebody's got to do the laundry, and you're both going to be men when the laundry's done. So the guy who does the laundry is no less masculine in the eyes of his husband than the guy who doesn't do the laundry. You know, I point to my own relationship maybe a little too often, but Terry does the cooking, I do the dishes. Terry repairs the car, I do the yard work. If there's a dead rat under the house, that's my job. If there's a sink that needs a tool, I don't even know the name of it, some sort of like that needs repairing, that's Terry's job. Terry grew up, you know, in a rural area and is comfortable with guns, and I shriek and run at the sight of a gun. In some ways, he's more feminine than I am. He's obsessed with clothing and fashion and crazy shoes. And I own, you know, three pairs of the identical tennis shoes. You know, everything was, what do you like to do? What are you good at? What will you do? What won't you do? Not, what are you expected to do? And in a way, we didn't have to opt out of gendered expectations because we didn't have any going in, because we opted out of gendered expectations when we were 15 and came out. And I think it would be healthy for more straight people if they could opt out of those gender expectations. And as always with these conversations, it's not just men doing it to each other and men doing it to women. Women do it to men too.
So I guess it's just, again, having those conversations right at the start of who wants to do what, and not having sort of expectations.
And then not having insecure meltdowns. Like Terry, who does the laundry, doesn't, when he's doing the laundry, feel like, okay, if my gender studies 101 professor saw me now, she'd be so disappointed in me, right? He doesn't have to worry that he succumbed to laundry because of the undertow of gender.
Right.
He does the laundry because he wants it done a certain way, and he's completely anal about it, and I can't do it. Not because, you know, the cultural forces finally got to him, and it's mere, you know, it's false consciousness that he thinks it's his own free choice. It couldn't be his free choice because he's a woman, and he's, you know, if he was a woman doing it, you know, he might have those doubts. He doesn't have those doubts. He does laundry because he likes it and he's good at it. And I don't, because I'm terrible at it, and he'd kill me if I tried to throw his shirts in the wash.
Hi, Dan. I'm Johnny. Do you think that gay people are worse with commitment than straight couples?
I think people often have that impression that gay people are worse with commitment. I think that it's that gay people commit a little later. My straight siblings were dating and having boyfriends and girlfriends and going to dances when they were 12. And I didn't get to start doing that until I was almost 20. And so all the lessons they learned at 13, I had to learn at 20, 21, 22, 23. And I wasn't ready to settle down or commit until I was in my 30s. And so I think sometimes straight people look at gay people who are having in their 20s the adolescence that straight people had in their teens and think, oh, they're so immature, they have a problem with commitment. And that's just not true. And there are some stats to back that up. The Netherlands, which has had same-sex marriage the longest, looked at who's likeliest to divorce. And it was lesbian couples were the most likely, straight couples were less likely, and gay male couples were the least likely to divorce. So who's got the commitment problem there?
Dan, I'm gay too. And what do you think that gay couples can learn from straight couples? Just a quick few points. Can we learn anything from them?
Can we learn anything from them that we haven't already learned from them? Most of us grow up with straight family, with straight parents. Most of us grow up embedded deep behind, not enemy lines, frenemy lines, in straight relationships. And a lot of what we need to learn from them, we've already learned from them. And straight people don't grow up around gay people in gay relationships. Most straight people with much exposure to same-sex relationships, and certainly not an intimate look at the dynamics of those same-sex relationships. So I think actually they have more to learn from us than we have to learn from them in adulthood, because we already learned what we needed to learn from them in childhood.
Dan, that's great. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't go into?
You know, there's some gender freakout in gay male land right now around mask for mask, and I wish everyone would calm down about it, because that's not a new thing. And some people's gendered performance is authentic, and some people's their gendered performance isn't authentic. But the mask for mask boys used to call themselves straight acting and appearing, and I'll take mask for mask over straight acting and appearing any day.
Why do you think there is still this? Did you say freakout, or am I imagining you said that?
There's a lot of like mask for mask shaming online right now.
Mm-hmm.
Guys who are too bro-y, of gay men who are too masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption is it's all an act, that there's no such thing as an authentically kind of traditionally masculine presenting gay man. And I think that's bullshit, that for some guys, this is their authentic gender expression. And we need to accept, as we have, in the middle of this gender revolution, that some people's authentic gender expression is going to align with their sex assigned at birth pretty comfortably. And not everybody who's, a masked straight guy or a masked gay guy is playing at it.
Has this gotten worse over the past few years, though?
Yeah. Here in the States, there's a lot of sort of Sturm und Drang and hand-wringing about, the mask guys and the bro-y gay guys, and whether this is a performance or a rejection of femi gay guys. And it doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be interpreted as one. Somebody whose gender expression is feminine, that can be as authentic as somebody whose gender expression is masculine. I think it's right to interrogate, a man's masculine gender expression a little bit more, because it's supported by the culture, and people may play it up or play at it to fit in a way that's, a guy who's feminine isn't trying to please the cultural expectations around his gender expression. So usually when a guy is femme, that's absolutely who they are. And they are boldly and bravely, being that and dropping any pretense or performance of masculinity and being boldly themselves. But I think that there are that guys who are masked can be just as authentic as guys who are femme. And I say that as somebody who's usually read as pretty masculine, although I feel like a big fucking show queen faggot 24 hours a day, but who's always been into femme guys myself. So yay, femme guys.
You heard from Dan Savage on this episode of The Gender Nut.
It was hosted by me. I'm Nastran Tavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman. Our brilliant, fantastic, awesome co-producers are Sam Baker and Jonathan Blackwell.
We'll be back in mid-October with another season.
And this is Jonathan signing off for now. Take care.